Red Letter N unfolds into a spectrum of colors.
Tonight, the harrowing case of the brutal beating and rape of the Central Park jogger that gripped the nation. And the wrongfully accused five young black men sent to prison for years is now a dramatic film series on Netflix called When They See Us.
I didn't see any lady.
Who are you talking about?
The lady in the park.
I didn't see a lady or hit anyone.
Raymond saw you hit her.
I'd sit down with visionary creator, co-writer, and director Ava DuVernay, the stunning all-star cast, and the real-life innocent men, once known as the Central Park Five.
What went through your mind when you heard the word guilty?
When They See Us is a gripping, dramatic telling of the story for the first time from the perspective of the men and their families. The four-part series is streaming globally now on Netflix. In the spring of 1989, 28-year-old Patricia Maley was found beaten, sexually assaulted, and barely alive in New York City's Central Park. Raymond Santana Jr., Kevin Richardson, Antron McRae, Yusef Salam, and Corey Wise, also in the park that night, were part of a large group of black and brown young teens rounded up and arrested by police.
I'd like to ask you some questions about a series of things that happened in Central Park.
Yes, ma'am.
It's widely reported that detectives, influenced by the head of the Manhattan District Attorney's Sex Crimes Unit, Linda Fairstein, coerced the young men, then just seventh and eighth graders, into signing confessions.
Did anybody tie her up?
Not that I know.
Did anybody move her body?
Though no DNA, fingerprints, or any physical evidence tied any one of them to the crime, all five were sentenced to between 5 and 15 years in prison and juvenile detention centers.
Rape in the first degree, sodomy in the first degree, sexual abuse in the first degree, attempted murder in the second degree.
13 years after the crime, in 2002, DNA evidence and a confession from the lone attacker, Mateus Reyes, proved their innocence. New York City vacated the convictions of Raymond, Kevin, Antron, Yusef, and Corey, and they were fully exonerated.
A title appears. Oprah Winfrey presents When They See Us Now. Oprah stands on a stage.
So let's get started and let's bring everybody out. She plays Dolores Wise, mother to Corey Wise. DC Nash. Playing the role of the adult Kevin Richardson, Justin Cunningham. Jovan Adepo plays Antron McRae as an adult. Welcome, Jovan. In the role of the adult,
Yusef Salam.
Chris Chalk. He plays the adult Raymond Santana Jr. Welcome, Freddie Mayarez. Jonathan King is executive producer on this project. Jonathan, and one of the executive producers of When They See Us, Barry Welsh. He plays Corey Wise as a young man and an adult, Jarrell Jerome.
Jarrell beams and flashes peace signs.
In the role of Kevin Richardson as a young man, welcome Asante Black. Playing the young Antron McRae, Khalil Harris. Ethan Harisi plays Yusef Salam as a young man. In the role of Bobby McRae, Antron McRae's father, Michael K. Williams. Mikey Joseph, the defense attorney for Antron McRae, is played by Joshua Jackson. One of the executive producers on When They See Us, Jane Rosenthal. And finally, the creator, the executive producer, the writer, the director, the visionary who shared every step of this film with the exonerated five, welcome Ava DuVernay.
The actors stand in front of their seats, arranged in two rows on stage left. Ava walks on stage and hugs Oprah, then sits next to her on stage right.
Hello, you.
Hello.
Hello. Hello. Hello. Hello. This is a moment we're having right here.
Yeah,
it is.
It's a beautiful moment.
It's a beautiful moment that we're having right here, that this film is so much more than a film. It's touched the zeitgeist in a way that few things can, especially in the world that is so overcrowded, as we know. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that moved me so is I was on Twitter and I saw this from actor LeVar Burton. Those of you who are old enough to know, you know LeVar Burton famously played Kunta Kinte children in Roots. And he tweeted this on June 2nd about the series. He said, "I had to keep breathing. Episode number one nearly broke my heart. However, I will keep watching because this is essential viewing for every American, as essential to your understanding of America as was Roots." Brava, Ava. Brava. That moved me. Because essential viewing, was that the intention?
Yes, that was the intention. Hello, everyone. We're on a real Oprah Winfrey show, OMG. I can't even believe it. I'm just going to keep on going.
Just keep going.
But yes, no, the goal was to create something that stuck to your ribs and that wasn't junk food. It was to create something that was going to be a catalyst for conversation. Entertainment serves all kinds of different purposes. I love horror, I love romance, I love action. But to be able to create something with my collaborators that is actually going to move people to action, move people to evaluate what they think and how they behave in the world, was our goal. And so to hear something like that from Mr. Burton, Roots being such a seminal series, something that really shifted the culture, was, you know, one of the best reviews we could get.
You know, I remember, for anyone who still doesn't know, the original title for the series was, the working title was at least Central Park 5. Mm-hmm. And I remember when there was some talk amongst the producers about whether or not we should keep that name or not keep that name, and you insisted that the name be changed. Why?
Central Park 5 felt like something that had been put upon the real men by the press, by the prosecutors, by the police. It took away their faces. It took away their families. It took away their pulses and their beating hearts. It dehumanized them. They are Yusuf, Antron, Kevin, Raymond, and Corey. And those are their names, and we need to know them and say their names. And so it became really important to think about that at every level. As a director, my job is to look at everything, and the title was a big part of it. It's the first time you meet the movie is when it walks up to you and says, "Hi, my name is..." And so we needed to be more than Central Park 5.
I know you're always, and you know, all directors and producers are anxious when something's going to open, and even when it's on Netflix spread over 190 countries, there still is that, is anybody going to watch? And then you wake up and it's trending. It's just trending.
Yeah.
What did you think?
I was stunned that whole day. You know, because with Netflix, it drops in 190 countries at the same time. So I'm getting tweets from the Netherlands, Brazil, Compton, you know, Iowa. It's all over the place. You hit that Twitter translation button, it's on IG, Instagram, it's Facebook. Everything was overloaded with the response. And I thought and I hoped that the piece would be respected. I really wanted the men's stories to be told and wanted them to be heard. But I didn't understand that it had the possibility to kind of shift the cultural conversation in the way that it's doing it now. That was kind of what you hope anything will do.
Yeah.
But this, on the day that it dropped in those 190 countries, it kind of exploded in a way that I think is a surprise maybe to...
Yeah, I was going to ask, were you
surprised? Was it a surprise for you?
I was surprised that it was trending, I can tell you that. Yeah.
Because I woke up...
Because I didn't think everybody was going to be watching, that many people would be watching at the same time.
Yes. Even in the United States, I woke up that morning at 6 a.m. and it was trending at like number 16, and I was like, wow, some people are... Oh gosh, this is great. And throughout the day, it just, as people woke up across the country, and I guess people don't work or they watch Netflix at work.
On the way to work.
On the way to work. There are people watching on subways, on their lunch breaks, but it just kept going up. And by the time it hit the evening and people got home from work on a Friday on the East Coast, it shot to number one and it stayed there all night and into the next day.
So. Yeah, I thought it was one of the best, most powerful uses of social media I've seen recently. So. You were surprised by the public. Have you been surprised by Linda Fairstein's response?
No, I wouldn't say I'm surprised by it.
Okay.
I think it's expected.
Linda Fairstein, you know, was a prosecutor in the Manhattan District Attorney's Office, and she led the sex crimes unit during this case. And it's, of course, been reported that she has stepped down from the board positions, some. and has also stepped down from charities and has been reported that she's been dropped by her publisher. What do you have to say about that?
I think it's important that people be held accountable. And that accountability is happening in a way today that it did not happen for the real men 30 years ago. But I think that it would be a tragedy if this story and the telling of it came down to one woman being punished for what she did, because it's not about her. Yep. Really, really not all about her. She is a part of a system that's not broken. It was built to be this way.
Yep. Okay? Yep.
It was built this way. It was built to oppress. It was built to control. It was built to shape our culture in a specific way that kept some people here and some people here. It was built for profit. It was built for political gain and power. And it is incumbent upon us. It lives off of us, our taxpayer dollars, our votes, the goods that we buy that are made inside of prisons. It lives off of our ignorance, and we can no longer be ignorant. Mm-hmm. And so the goal of this, okay, Linda Fairstein, okay, Elizabeth Lederer, okay, all of these people on this particular case who need to be held accountable. But the real thing that we are all trying to do, all of the artists who collaborated with me, she's asking the question, but she knows the answer. Because she wants me to do it because she loves me. Go, Ava, that's what you're doing. Our real goal is to be able to say, go, America, let's do this, let's change this. And you can't change what you don't know, so we came together to show you what you may not know. Now that you know, what will you do? How will you change this? That's our goal.
Okay, good job. So now I want to talk to the boys. These beautiful young actors who play Raymond, Kevin, Yusef, Antron, and Corey as young men. I'm going to start with you, Ethan. Did you all understand the weight of the story when you started?
Yes. Researching the case and watching the Ken Burns documentary and, you know, reading the script and everything, you could tell.
Had you heard of it before the Ken Burns documentary?
I had not, no. I had not heard of it before I auditioned for it last year. That was my first time.
Really? Yeah. Khalil?
I hadn't heard of the case prior to getting the audition either, but I feel like we all understood the gravity of it, and we met each other practically, you know, strangers, but there was that immediate sense of brotherhood, and there was that immediate sense of family, because we were all united in a common goal. And I feel like when there's a bunch of people united in a common goal, the result can be so powerful.
Mm-hmm. So as young Black men yourselves during filming, some of you were actually the ages of the exonerated five when they were put into jail. How did you prepare to do that?
Yeah. Hi, Oprah.
Hi.
Asante grins. Oprah and several actors applaud.
Hi, Asante.
Yeah, no. But I feel like the biggest preparation was just talking to them themselves, you know, getting a sense of who they were, just seeing the lights that they were, how radiant they were. You see these guys and you never think that they went through what they went through, you know. They could come out bitter, you know, at the world, but they come out smiling and happy. Whenever Ava describes Kevin, she describes him as a big teddy bear, because that's what he is. So I wanted to take, you know, kind of the good in him and the sweetness and put that into, you know, try to transform that into the innocence, because pain and sorrow isn't all that he is. You know, there's so much more to who he is, to who these five men are. This is one tragic part of their life, but they have entire lives outside of it as well. So I wanted to portray that too.
Beautifully, beautifully. So
Oprah turns to Jarrell.
What can we say about you? I don't even know what we can say about you.
Jarrell smiles and makes a dismissive gesture.
Jarrell is the only actor to play one of the exonerated five as both a young man and also as an adult playing Corey. Everybody's performance is seared on my heart, but I felt gutted by yours, I have to tell you. And I have to say, what you did, you brought us into solitary confinement. And that moment where you say, nobody believes in me, nobody wants, I could feel that for everybody who's ever felt that in their life, that moment. And when that damn air conditioner worked, we felt cooled by the breeze. You did that so well. So I don't have words to actually describe what your artistry did for all of us. I am curious, we all are curious, about what was the process of you embodying Corey Wise?
Jarrell straightens, his shoulders tense.
Hi.
Hi. Trying not to cry right now. Thank you, Oprah, so much. It was a the hardest thing I've ever done or allowed myself to do to get into that emotion and to get into that mentality. I just want to start off by saying, bottom line, I could never be Corey Wise. No one could ever be Corey Wise or fill those shoes. I just did my best to embody him, and that's my bottom line. It was a multiple-step process for me. It was intense. It was a lot of layers for Corey Wise. I think if you meet him, you'd see that he is probably one of the most unique person you'll ever see or you'll ever meet. Uh-huh. It's finding those quirks and those physicalities that make Corey Wise who he is. It started with the voice for me. I did 2 months with a vocal coach and just learning how to speak like Corey, which is, it was the biggest challenge in itself. I learned a simple trick that allowed me to put my voice in a deeper resonance and get that Harlem accent going and get rid of that fast-speaking Spanish voice that I got going on. And once I found the voice, I think you can contest to this, it kind of just went down the body and into the legs. And it became, it was so weird. It's the first time I ever felt like I truly stepped out of my own body and stepped into somebody else's. And it was because Corey allowed me to do it. I spent a lot of time with him walking in the streets of Harlem. He bought me a pair of sneakers the first time we hung out. I was like, don't buy me these kicks. He was like, I have to. I'm Corey Wise. Corey Wise buys Corey Wise sneakers. And I was like, I want those right there. And that's his spirit. And that kept me calm. Even as an audience member, when you're watching this type of show, you feel that weight, you feel that pain, you feel that anger. So just to be on that cold floor in the cell and just to be alone day after day in a scene by yourself, it wasn't hard to simply think about Corey and think about the fact that I'm only spending about 3 months trying to tap into what he's doing. He spent 12 years behind that. So. Yeah.
So Siobhan, Chris, Justin, Freddie, and Jarrell all played the men as adults. So I want to know how you all approach bringing their humanity to life. The world knew them as just a derogatory headline for decades. That's what we're saying. But from this day forward, we call them the Exonerated Five, mm-hmm. not the Central Park Five. Mm-hmm. Everybody spread the word. Mm-hmm. Siobhan, how would you answer that? How did you do that?
The main thing I wanted to do was get a chance to meet Antron and try to get him to open up to me and just really figure out, I guess, the core of his story. And I was fortunate enough that Ava sent me out to Georgia to meet Antron, and I spent the first day just spending time with his family and his kids and his wife, and Raymond was there at the time, too, and I listened.
Yeah. I think one of the issues that is coming forth and the reason why this is so much more than a film and is a moment for our culture is because people who ordinarily would not be exposed to these stories, but because of Netflix, they are, now get a glimpse into how challenging it can be to put your life back together after being incarcerated. And I thought you all did such a beautiful, beautiful job of that. You did. Mm-hmm. Did you learn something yourself about that process?
I think for me, getting to know Kevin, I realized that I tend to forget about a lot of things. I like forget that I have a certain level of privilege in my life. And I sort of forget that my freedom can be taken away at any moment. And I move through life sort of forgetting about that and not realizing that. And getting to meet Kevin, I sort of understood about his sister and his family, how much they supported him and how much they fought for him. And they were always there for him, and that support was always there. And it's, for me, I learned from this experience that I can never forget that there are always people in your corner. They're always going to be fighting for you.
Mm-hmm. Freddie, I heard you said that working with Ava was like a masterclass.
Yes, absolutely. You know, this was my first experience getting to fully realize a character. Not only that, realizing a living, real person, that presents its own sets of challenges. You have to honor their truth. in a story like this that has such emotional weight and the responsibility that I as an actor have to uphold. Fortunately, I had Ava on my corner. She was always encouraging me to go deeper. She was supporting me and constantly, constantly pushing to go further. And I learned every single time that I could. There was always room to go deeper.
Yeah.
And as an actor, we have to be vulnerable to the circumstances that are presented. And it's challenging having to confront these kinds of circumstances. But without honoring this story and without putting ourselves in that position, this show would not have the success that it has today.
So, Chris, were there any moments on set where you were particularly struck by the fact that what you were doing or experiencing, the exonerated five actually went through?
I will say the two most important moments on set. One, walking into a makeup costume room with all black people, which doesn't seem like a big deal, but everybody up here knows that's impossible. And that is a testament to what Ava represents, and it is everything. And then second, just hanging out with Dr. Salaam and seeing how he has transcended his pain and become such a leader for people in his circumstance inspired me to just do more, be better. Like, if he can do it, please, everybody here can do better.
Mm-hmm. Ava said many times in the press, when a person is incarcerated, I think this is what comes through too, that the whole family is in prison, and we rarely focus on the family and the injustices mm-hmm. and how that impacts them. Michael K. Williams.
Michael smiles. A scar runs from the center of his forehead down to his right cheek. Gray stubble covers his chin.
Michael grew up in New York around the same time these events happened. What did you pull from to bring the role of Bobby McCrae to life?
Hello, Oprah.
Hello. Yeah.
My mom loves you.
Thank you.
I remember the fear. I remember the fear of not wanting to be lumped, not wanting to be generalized with them. You know, I would see these men, these young boys on the television, and I would hear what they were accused of and what they had confessed to. And I'm a victim of Wilding. These scars on my face, I got jumped. I got jumped by a pack of other young boys, you know, and I almost lost my life. I know what Wilding looks like, and I know what it feels like. I know that trauma. I know what it feels like to almost lose your life being jumped by a group of men. So I had that trauma, and then I would look and I would see I didn't see that in the screen. I didn't see it, just wasn't making sense. But the narrative was, in my household, something didn't add up, right? But then it must add up because they said it was true. Yeah. They confessed. That's all we had to go on. I just remember the fear and the trauma of even changing the way I dressed. You know, I didn't remember that until I got on the set and I started to dig into the context of, like, you know, what they were going through. When I remember what I was going through, I changed the way I dressed because I was afraid that they would think I was one of them.
Wow. You know what? I remember years ago doing an Oprah show, and there were fathers in the audience, and I remember this black man stood up and said, every father has a dream for his family, and if he cannot fulfill that dream, it leaves a hole in his soul as well as in the hole of his family. And I thought, maybe you saw that show, or somehow you knew that the hole in the soul that the fathers of the world have felt when they can't be there for their sons. Because that is what you did for this role, Michael K. Williams. That is what you did. And when you were on that witness stand, and it's lit so beautifully, we can actually see the previous scar, and you are being questioned by the prosecution, and you say that you did believe that by telling your son. Where did that come from? How did you do that?
Again, I could have easily have been one of those boys growing up in New York City. And unlike them, I was at risk. So I was doing things that put me in a situation where the police could have picked me up. I could have been in the custody of the police. So, you know, my mom raised me. You know, I had a, you know, thank God for her. And I remember the trauma I put her through of her worrying over me and everything. And then I saw my mom and the ignorance. My mom didn't know about what our rights were, and she just knew, you go to school, I'm going to work, we meet back at the ranch. That's what I was taught. And so we didn't, there was no time to find out what if this happens, what do you do? So, you know, when I had the pleasure of speaking to Miss Linda, this is Linda McCray, this is Antoine's mom, who was a very private lady, and she blessed myself and Marsha, who plays her, she blessed us with like 2 hours of conversation. And she was, I guess, on her deathbed. She didn't live to see when they see us, right? And so when we spoke to her that day on the phone, all she said was, she only spoke about Bobby. She only referred to him as my husband or the father of my child. Hmm. So the love and admiration and compassion that she had for him, I knew then that I had to dig deeper. You know, on paper, he looks like a man who made some very bad decisions. He split when the going got rough. But after I spoke to Miss Linda, I knew that I owed it to her and to him to dig deeper and to find out what drove him away from his family. It wasn't that he didn't care or he didn't love them or he just said, the heck with it. Like you said, there's a saying, I don't know where it come from, if a man cannot protect or provide for his family, then what is left of a man? And when I believe that when Bobby realized that he was a pawn, that he was the nail in the ceiling of his son's casket, I believe that the guilt, the anger, the frustration, and the shame.
The shame.
The shame.
That's what you did so beautifully, is the shame. That's what you conveyed so beautifully. And that scene between you and Khalil in the bathroom where he says, ain't nobody blaming you, and then you said, I'm blaming myself. The shame. It's, mm-hmm. You did it.
Thank you.
You nailed that thing. Mm-hmm. Joshua Jackson played Mickey Joseph, defense attorney for Antoine McCray. What did you learn about the justice system?
Nothing good. Well, truthfully, I mean, thankfully I'm on Mickey was on the right side of the argument, but no matter what his best efforts were, and he really was a true believer. I mean, he was really truly on the right side of this argument, and what you see in the show is right and real. I mean, they put up a good defense, and they pulled apart the pieces that didn't make any sense, and pulled out even evidence that wasn't supposed to be there at some times, but he still lost. I don't know about all y'all, but when I'm watching that, even having read the scripts, knowing where this story is going, I'm sitting there in the second episode, and I'm like, somebody's going to say it. Yep. Somebody's going to stop this. Somebody's going to put their hands up, and we can't do this to these children. Mm. And I don't think it was that far away in 1989 either. The media narrative was one thing, but if you were in that room, if you were part of that defense team, if you were part of that prosecutorial team, you knew what you were doing. Everybody knew. It was right there in front of them, and there was two trials, so they had two bites to get it wrong, and they got it wrong both times. So what did I learn about the justice system is that it's the wrong name for it.
Mm. Actors and audience members applaud. A woman in the audience raises her hands and points forward, nodding.
Well, you know, now we're going to talk to Miss Niecy Nash. You saved the lady for last. You began your research to play Corey's mother. You were telling me this just last night, by calling Corey's mother. What was that conversation like?
It was hard, because the one thing I can tell you would still keep in her confidence is that her pain was so palpable. It was like right at the surface. And
were you nervous making the call?
Yes, because you kind of don't know what to say. You try to lead with what you think is the right thing, and I wasn't quite sure how to lean in. But my takeaway was that a lot of people may think that because something happened to you many years ago, it should be in your rear view. But that residue that was on the altar of her heart, you can't tell somebody when to brush that off. You know, there's a lot of work that is involved in that. And it was tough. it was tough.
What did you learn that informed your playing of her?
That at any given moment, as a parent, you are doing the best you can with whatever resources you have. This is a mother who was afraid and she was vulnerable, but she did not feel like she could say that or express that because the weight of the world was on her shoulders to see this family through. So she masked it with anger. So I needed to find a balance of all of those things.
Well, I think it's so extraordinary that for most of your life, the world has seen you as a comedian. We're used to seeing you looking flawless on Clawless.
And yes, ma'am.
As a fun-loving diva. So how long have you known that you had inside you this drug-addicted, verbally abusive, pain-filled mother, then finding God, forgiving the enemies, and all of that? How long have you known that that's what you could do?
When I was 5 years old, I saw the most gorgeous black woman I had ever seen in my little 5 years of living. She had a long red dress on and her eyelashes looked like butterflies. And I said, Grandmama, who is that? And she said, baby, that's Lola Falana. And in that moment, I felt like God stamped on the canvas of my imagination, my destiny. But I thought I was going to do drama. And that was what I thought the path was going to be. I never thought being funny was anything because I got pinched in church for cracking jokes. I got put on punishment. My mama's sitting right over there, she can tell you, for, you know, talks too much on my report card. And so I always saw it, but the industry never saw it. And though the vision tarries, I waited a long time for people to understand that people who can make you laugh can make you cry.
Thank you to the cast, the producers from When They See Us. Bravo.
Darkness. Then Oprah stands near Ava.
So 30 years ago, their youth and their freedom were unjustly torn away in a case that made headlines around the world and terrorized and divided a city. They are the five men who, as teenagers, were falsely convicted and imprisoned for the beating and rape of the woman known as the Central Park Jogger. Their story, from their perspective, is told in the Netflix drama, When They See Us. All five of the exonerated men are here. Please welcome Yousef Salaam, Kevin Richardson, Antron McCray, Raymond Santana Jr., and Corey Wise.
The tall Yousef wears a trim gray suit. He hugs Oprah. The bald Kevin enters in a blue button-down shirt. Antron and Raymond, also bald, wear T-shirts with the names of the five men emblazoned on the front. The wiry Corey wears his hair cropped close and a goatee. He stands at the far left of the stage facing the audience. He takes a deep bow. Yousef moves to pat Corey's shoulder.
Get off me.
Corey and Oprah embrace.
Love. Love.
They separate. Corey and Ava grasp hands. She kisses his cheek. The exonerated five sit on stage left at an angle to Oprah and Ava's seats.
So I want to start by asking each of you about the boy you were on April 18th, 1989, 24 hours before this whole nightmare began. What were your hopes, your dreams? How would your family or friends, your teachers describe you? Who were you, Yousef?
Wow. That is the most important questions, I think. You know, being a young person full of hope, full of dreams, full of ideas, wanting to just be. You know, God said be, and it is. I think about that often because for me, my whole life changed. You know, I went from riding skateboards and, you know, probably climbing trees and playing Ring Alivio 1, 2, 3, you know. I mean, the most romantic thing I think I did back then was walk around the lake and hold hands, you know. And I think that those memories kind of stayed with me throughout prison. And it was difficult to digest that.
Hmm. Who were you, Kevin?
Wow. I remember April 18th, being excited to be out of school,
because it was the Easter vacation. And also trying to balance my music, playing trumpet, and also one of my goals was to play for Syracuse University, but I never reached that, you know, so watching this project, it always takes me back to about being 14 and being in that humble, naive state. And I just always wish I could go back to that.
Antron?
I played a lot of sports. My father had me practicing a lot. Actually, I just got back from Puerto Rico from playing on a traveling team. I'm shy now. And just, you know, this was enjoying my life, you know.
Where was your hope for yourself? Did you have one yet?
Yes, to be a baseball player.
Be a baseball player.
Yes, yeah. Baseball player.
Yeah. Raymond?
I loved listening to hip-hop music. I loved shopping at the Gap. Well, my dad, right? Oh, it was always his money. And I loved the sketch. That was my thing. For me, I didn't think about what I would be later on in life because I was a 14-year-old boy.
Yeah.
I was just enjoying the moment.
Who were you, Corey?
Just being Corey, that's all.
You were just being Corey, having fun, and you and Yusef would hang out together.
Yeah, yeah. Yes, ma'am.
Watching the film from the time the actors are being interrogated, we get to experience how shocking and egregious it all was. But we, as the audience, knew the verdict. We wanted it to be different. I want to know what went through your mind when you heard the word guilty.
Life was over.
Raymond.
A 14-year-old boy couldn't see past tomorrow. And here I was later on, you're like, you know, my attorney at the time, you know, he comes in there and after they take my tie and my belt and my shoelaces, and he says, you know, 5 years, you're still young, don't worry about it. For me, it just felt like forever. Right? I couldn't see 5 years. So it just felt like forever, like it was going to never end.
Does it feel out of body? I interviewed a beautiful man named Anthony Ray Hinton, who spent 30 years on death row, and through the Equal Justice Institute, and Bryan Stevenson was freed about 3 years ago. But he spent 30 years on death row for a crime he did not commit in the state of Alabama. And he said when he heard the guilty verdict, he literally went blind. He literally went blind. He could not see. And he was out of his body. I'm wondering, did you experience something like that, Antron?
Yeah, kind of. I felt numb. I was the first one. The ride asked me to stand up, and they read the charges off. And I just felt numb, and then right after that, I lost my religion. I started hating everything in the world.
Antron's biceps flex. He looks down. Then Kevin.
You know, being at the time I was 16, you know, that I was older, I literally thought my life was over right in front of me. Because I really didn't process that I was receiving a 5 to 10 years. I thought I might die right in jail because the whole world hated us, that we felt that. And like a mob mentality was against us. So during that time, I really thought my life was over. I didn't know where to go. I was just stuck.
Yusef, do you remember the moment?
You know, it's hard for me because when I remember those moments, I try to put that stuff behind me because it gets me very emotional. I went from being free, I was on bail. And I remember talking to a friend on the phone, and I said, they got the verdicts. I'll see you in a little while. And guilty was echoed in the courtroom so many times, I lost count. And they told us to put our hands behind our backs. And they led us into the back. And we hugged each other and cried. It was such a painful cry. We didn't get a chance to have a going away party as other folks. We didn't get a chance to prepare. And it was such a difficult thing to now imagine this new normal, this what is this going to be like? I'm going to have to fight. I'm going to have to protect myself. This is the worst crime that you can go to prison for.
Yeah.
The only crime that trumps rape is child molestation. And prisoners were being polled. What are you going to do to them when you get in, when they get in there?
Oh.
And untold horrors were being whispered about what they were going to do to us.
We saw some of what happened to Corey on film, because Ava says if she were, she couldn't, you couldn't show all of it.
No, one of the first things, you know, all of the men went through the loss of their innocence in the moment that they are brought into the precinct that day, and you see it in the first episode. Four of them, the four who just spoke, went to juvenile detention and then eventually matured into adult prisons in the state of New York. Corey Wise, at the moment that he stepped foot off of that street in Harlem, never came back for another 13 and a half years. There was no bail. He never got bailed out. He never saw the light of day again. He went directly into Rikers at 16 years old, okay? So he had a different experience. When I first sat with him, he said, Ava, you could tell my story, but you need to know, right now I feel that it's 4+1, because at least they were together and I was alone, and I had a different experience. So that was one of the things in collaborating with all of the men, was trying to tell their experience. They've become a brotherhood, they've become the five, but all of them agreed that we needed to make sure that, and it was a lot of conversations with Raymond, who was the first person to approach me. He said, Corey's story is different. Make sure that you tell his story. His story needs to be heard for him, for us, for all of us. And so that was the experience.
And the thing that...
You already know it's all love.
The thing that's echoed throughout the film is the fact that you just were going down to support your friend. And so were there many times you regretted going down to support your friend?
Corey grimaces. His eyes fill with tears.
I do.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah.
I do.
Yeah. You did.
I do. Yeah, mixed feelings.
Mixed feelings about it. Do you all blame Linda Fairstein for what happened to you?
Yeah.
Raymond nods.
You do?
Yeah.
Is she the only person you blame, or are there others?
Corey, you got an answer?
Yeah.
She was just doing a job, but it caught up to her.
Mm.
It caught up to her. Behind closed doors, she was just doing a job, but it's caught up to her.
He gives a wave.
Mm-hmm.
It came overwhelming for her, right? Yeah.
Raymond.
As a prosecutor, you know, that moment that DNA evidence comes back and it doesn't match, right? And we're talking handprints, footprints, hair samples, blood, clothing, and nothing matches. Is that at that moment, this was her chance for her to take a step back and say, let me reevaluate. Something's wrong here because it doesn't match.
Absolutely.
Then we find out later on during deposition that they tested over 40 kits and no DNA match. And so it's that pivotal moment that she had the power in her hand to really do the right thing, and she fumbled it.
Yeah.
And she kept pushing forward.
Kevin.
I believe she was one of many. You know, I think she was the culprit of it, because people was going by what she said. Like, she was basically telling them what to do, and they abided by that. So I think she was one of many, but there's still many more that still need to be exposed.
Mm-hmm.
And I think speaking our truth, and they seen the vision of this, that would do it for itself. We don't need to do anything else. The truth will come out.
How did you all protect yourself? Because first you were in juvenile detention, and then as you aged out, you were put in prison, and people knew who you were. So how did you protect yourselves? Number one, yeah.
I added on some weight, and I became real aggressive.
You became aggressive?
Yeah, so I wasn't getting picked on.
Yeah.
So I became kind of a troublemaker.
Yeah. And?
Well, you know, at the time, as you can see, I was a little bit taller than Asante, but I was little. And, you know, I know Raymond may remember this. When we went to Spofford, I looked at Raymond, I said, all we have is each other. You know, and it was about to, we literally grew up right there. You know, I went from 16 to becoming a man because I had to defend myself.
Mm-hmm.
So unfortunately, we had to adapt to our environment.
When you would dream, I often wonder this, in prison, were you free in your dreams?
Yeah. I had several dreams like that where I would just wake up. Like, at the moment, I'm free. I'm outside or I'm in my house talking to my dad. And then when I woke up, I was in prison.
Uh-huh.
And I heard other inmates have those dreams. And I was like, that's crazy. And so I had it. And I was like, wow, it felt so real at that moment to be in my house moving around talking to my dad and then wake up and I'm in prison.
I bet it made you look forward to sleeping then, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Did you all know that Corey had it as bad as he did before you saw the film?
No. One of the things that I told the gentleman as we watched this, I said, wow, this was almost like a play of words on us as well, because not only will the world get an opportunity to see us for the first time, but we got an opportunity to see each other. We never spoke about or discussed how our experiences were. We had made assumptions that we had gone through the same exact thing. And I think it was important for us to be able to really see the trauma of 30 years, these individual stories, but also the amazing piece of a puzzle, I would say, this magic that Corey has. And here he wasn't even a suspect. And he goes down and he becomes the absolute thing that freed us. And I so appreciated that, because for me, like, that's my guy right there, you know? He had my back. He was my ace in the hole. And I will forever have his back.
Mm.
And I thought that was important, you know, very important.
So can you tell us how you're able to hold on to sanity?
I used to meditate. Mm. You know, those very real opportunities for me to be able to think about the opportunity of being free gave me so much hope. You know, I knew that one day I would step out of this hell that I was in. And I think meditating was my ability to imagine, how am I going to step back into the world?
Mm-hmm.
How am I going to, I know it's going to be difficult, but I'm going to be stumbling. How am I going to make sure that I don't fall on my face?
Mm.
You know, meditation was tremendous.
For you. How'd you hold on to your sanity, Antron?
By threat, even to this day.
Mm.
I'm damaged. I need help. I know it, but I just try to keep myself busy. The system broke a lot of things in me that can't be fixed.
Yeah. Do you feel broken?
Yes, ma'am. My wife asked me to go see, you know, a therapist, but I keep refusing.
Why?
I keep myself busy. I work out. I ride my motorcycle and go see Ray. He lives right 5 minutes away from me, so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I'm struggling.
But wouldn't going to therapy offer you a kind of real freedom and a kind of peace? Don't you yearn for that, or do you yearn for that?
No, ma'am.
You don't?
I lost my mother.
Your mother died not too long ago.
Yes, ma'am. She's the only one there for me at that time. My father left.
Antron bites his lip. Kevin lays a hand on his shoulder.
Man.
Yusuf pounds one of his fists atop the other.
So we get to see in the film that beautiful scene where Michael Kay is in the bed and is being put down by his son, grown son. Did you ever have reconciliation with your father? Did you ever forgive him for convincing you to lie?
No, ma'am. Like I said before, he's a coward.
Mm-hmm.
I have 6 kids, 4 boys, 2 girls. I couldn't imagine doing that to my son.
Mm-hmm.
He allowed him to mush me, pulled me in my chest. No, ma'am.
No.
I hate him.
Antron stares downward. In the audience, Jarell and Ethan weep.
My life is ruined.
Kevin squeezes Antron's shoulder.
So, even with this, so tell us this, Antron. It feels like this movie has brought a sense of not just recognition to you, Exonerated Five, but it feels like something is happening in the whole country, that this art has now elevated the conversation to the point
that we at least are willing to look at the injustices. And you were a part of that. Does none of this feel like some kind of redemption? I ask that of you and the rest of you. That
not for me, ma'am. I appreciate it, though. Y'all probably know more about my case than I do. I just know I didn't do it. My brothers didn't do it. So I ran away from everything. I left New York.
So what do you want to say about this cycle that you now have been a huge part of injustice and racism?
Hmm. You know, here we are, 30 years later. Not too many things has changed. I'm so happy and ecstatic that we can start the conversation now and to make sure there will never be another Central Park 5 and make sure we have the platform to make sure of that. So I understand what Antron means. It is bittersweet because watching this is painful, but it's necessary.
Yes.
This needs to be watched.
Yes.
We need to make sure things change now.
So for your fathers now raising your own children and as black men in the United States, what do you tell your sons about what to do if stopped by a police officer?
Don't say anything. Don't say anything. Wait till I get there.
Wait till we
get there. Actually, wait till we get there.
Raymond points to Antron and himself, grinning.
Yeah, ask for a lawyer. First of all, you shouldn't get in trouble at all. So he gonna have problems anyway if you get in trouble. He shouldn't get no problems at all, but just ask for a lawyer. We'll be there. Don't say anything.
You know, we were talking about everybody watching the film and it reigniting all of the trauma. I was watching you last night, Corey, watch the fourth episode and with Jarrell, and I can't imagine being you watching that happening. How is that for you to see that reenacted?
Corey blows a kiss to Jarrell. Jarrell returns the gesture.
That's how it was.
That's how it was. Yeah.
It was just bittersweet.
Bittersweet.
Looking at my life where I couldn't look at it when I was going through poetry in motion. So it's for him to introduce my pain to me. Mm. I said, wow, life after death. Thank you, Biggie, life after death. He just made me a reality of it.
Does it feel like now for you this is life after death?
Yes.
Do you all remember the exact moment that you heard someone by the name of Mateus Reyes had confessed to this crime that you'd paid your life for?
When did you hear that he had done it, Corey? Because you were still in for quite a while after.
My mom had called an oil burn.
Your mom called?
She's like, Corey's, I don't know about you. Somebody's always loving you. And Reyes.
He shrugs.
Just as it's portrayed in the film.
That's what he told me,
yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Somebody loves you.
Somebody loves you, yeah. Do you remember where you were when you heard?
I was in Franklin Correctional, and I had called my dad. And he was just so hype on the phone. And I said, I don't know, they brought me down here, because that's the processing center. And I didn't know why I was there. And I said, they brought me down here and they asked me all these questions. And he said, and he just was like, because you're getting ready to come home. And I was like, what are you talking about? And he's like, they found the guy that did it. They found him. And I literally was like, as you see in the doc, I cursed at him. And like, you know.
Yeah.
And I was like, and I hung up on him. You know, mm-hmm. I literally hung up on him. I couldn't believe it. I was just so institutionalized by that point that I felt that I wasn't going to get out of prison. I just was like, whatever.
Antron, do you remember?
Yes, ma'am. I just got off of work. I used to work the third shift. And took a shower, turned on ESPN, and got something to eat. And my cousin called me. And he's just, Tron, the truth came out. And I'm just like, what are you talking about? He said, your case, turn. It was some new station. And I was like, you serious? And he's like, yeah, turn it on. And I turned it on, and We was on there. And then my mother called, and she's like, "Baby, the truth came out, and they caught the man who did it." We didn't know what was going on,
yeah.
And I was like, "Yeah, I was in Maryland." And she's like, "Now, do you believe in God?" I was like, "Nah, ma, no." And I was like, "Nah, ma, I didn't do it, so the truth's gonna come out eventually, one day." But my mother said, "But he kept you alive, baby, to see it." Mm-hmm. Yes. And I was like, rewrite mom. Mm-hmm.
Kevin, where were you?
Yeah, I remember I was working a night shift, and you see I was working in a nursing home, and people was telling me that it was on, and I went to watch it. And I remember that point, I left work. I didn't care if I was getting fired. I didn't care about anything. I ran home to my mother, and we had a moment where we hugged, and we hugged for about 10 minutes straight.
Wow.
And she said, it's true, it's true. I told you the truth would come out. You know, and that's what I remember from that day.
Wow. Yeah. Yusuf?
Wow. I remember saying to myself, wow, they found the guy who did this. And then I had this weird thought. They're going to make this into the sixth man.
Yeah.
And they're going to somehow bury this. We didn't do this. Mm-hmm. And sure enough, they made it. We came home. Well, I shouldn't say we came home. We came out from underneath the system in late 2002. We filed lawsuits to get some type of restorative justice. It took another 12 years for the city to take care of the lawsuits. It took another 12 years. It was from 2002.
Well, the city set up a lawsuit, but they've never apologized. No one has ever apologized to the men or their families for not what happened, but what was done.
Yeah.
What was done.
Everybody hears you got a settlement, and they think, oh, okay, so you got money.
Right.
Can money heal?
No.
No, not at all.
No.
Money can't take back the time that we lost in those years. We will never get that back. We cannot bring that back, no matter what. You know, we're happy that we're able to provide for our families, get to feel good as a man to do so. Mm-hmm. Like Yusuf always say, we have invisible scars that nobody sees.
That's right.
That can never be erased.
And try.
It helped out, but my mother passed away from cancer, and I couldn't buy her a kidney, pancreas. I just watched her die in front of me. And I couldn't do anything to save her. With the money in the world, we, you know, that people thought we had, I couldn't even save my mother. I couldn't save my mother at all. Mm. You know, so.
Yeah. Raymond?
I mean, in some instances, it made it worse. Because people forgot that we had to split it five ways. We had to pay attorney fees.
Yeah.
Right? And so now when you came in, they go, oh, you got $40 million.
Yeah.
Me? By myself?
Yeah.
Right? And so it made it worse in some instances.
Yeah. But you all were at least all married. You're single, so did you have a lot of women who wanted to be your friend?
Corey grins.
My phone's still going on.
So what gives you hope today?
The fight.
Yeah.
I mean, since, you know, it took them 2.5 years to charge us, try us, convict us, and send us to prison, and then forget about us. And what they forgot, what they didn't realize was that we still here.
Yeah.
Right? We're grown now.
Yeah.
And they will have to deal with us for the rest of their lives.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
Anything give you hope, Antron?
My kids, my wife.
Kids, yeah.
Yes, ma'am.
So I asked that question of you, Yusuf.
I'm hopeful. Now the world is getting an opportunity not only to see what it was that we went through, but also see that we survived. They took diamonds and threw it in the dirt. And we were still diamonds. And when they picked us up, we were still diamonds, still unbreakable, still strong. And I think that for young people, for the future generations that are going to absolutely change this system, that's what gives me hope.
So has Ava fulfilled or exceeded your expectation?
Exceeded.
Yes.
Exceeded.
Exceeded.
Far and beyond.
Far and beyond. Yeah.
Thank you, sir.
Far and beyond.
Yeah.
That was the biggest thing. I wanted them to love it. You know, as a filmmaker, you, over the years, you think about critics and awards and, you know, your peers, and you want other filmmakers to love it, and you want the public to love it, and this was for them to love it, the five of them. I remember when we screened it in Los Angeles, Netflix was kind enough to fly them all out, and I sat behind Corey, and I watched them all watch it. I watched them all learn each other's stories, because they were in their own isolated, their own life, so they didn't know the intricacies of what was happening behind doors in the other man's story, particularly with Corey's story. And afterward, they all embraced each other and me. We all had tears. And we understood each other a little bit more. And hopefully from people understanding these men, they'll understand.
That's got to be one of the greatest things as a...
Well, there's no review. There's no... I mean, the reviews have been really lovely. I haven't read them. And for the first time. Because there's nothing else that can beat the moment. When Corey Wise stands up after you see episode 4, I was sitting right behind him. He stood up and I was terrified. I didn't know what he was going to say. Mm. And he had tears in his eyes and he said, "You did it. You got it right." And he embraced me. And, you know, and they all have different ways that they express themselves and communicate. But you all gave me the honor of communicating with me in your own way and letting me listen to you and let me tell the story. And I hope. My hope for you is that you don't have to keep telling the story. It's been told, and you can live your life knowing that you won, right? You won, and we believe you, and we see you.
Yes.
We believe you, and we see you.
We see you. Yeah. Yeah. Thank you, Antron, Kevin, Youssef, Raymond, and Corey. Yeah. Thank you.
They all stand.
Yeah. Let's grab.
The exonerated five hold hands and raise them above their heads. Credits: Director Mark Ritchie, Executive Producers Oprah Winfrey, Brian Piotrowicz, Mark Ritchie, Aaron Latham James. A Southpaw Production. Copyright 2019. Own Oprah Winfrey Network.
The red letter N unfolds into a spectrum of colors.